Hello and welcome to The Sound of Science. My name is Julia Zimbauer, and I'm the creator and host of this new podcast. The Sound of Science podcast aims to educate on the neuroscience of music, but it respectfully pays attention to all the ways that music can affect us, from the mind and the body to our emotions. In later episodes, we will dive into music and mental health, as well as different disorders and their interactions with music. Some of our later episodes will even feature some interviewed guests, and I'm so excited to introduce them to you guys. But for our first episode, we are talking about the biological effects of music on the brain, especially how we are able to neurologically perceive, interpret, see, and learn music. How are we able to hear music? Why do we love music so much? How are we able to see written music, and how do we learn it? To start understanding the way that we perceive music, we first have to look at our brain. Our brain is essentially the entire reason that we are able to see, encode, understand, and have physical responses to music. The brain also helps control other physical functions of our body. Depending on the types of music that we love and we listen to, our heart rate can be affected, along with things like our blood pressure, pupil dilation, and even our breathing rate. This can also contribute as to why we choose certain song tempos for specific things, which is why we probably wouldn't listen to classical music at the gym, why we would choose a Pitbull song for a party, and why we wouldn't play heavy metal for a sleeping baby. Now let's go back to the brain. Our brain is made up of four different lobes. The occipital lobe, which is at the back of our head, primarily helps with vision. The frontal lobe, which is probably the most commonly heard of lobe that you've probably studied in some of your science classes. It helps with planning, thinking, and overall executive functions. So it's kind of the decision maker of the brain. We also have the parietal lobe, which processes our sensory information, and the temporal lobe, whose main function is to store and process information, but also has a key role in memory processing. Keeping this information in mind, let's look at what happens when we first hear sound. When we hear sound, the sound waves first hit our eardrums, which are small flaps of skin in our ears. We have these really small bones in our ears that are called ossicles. These help carry the sound further to convert these sound waves into electrical signals. This is primarily done in something that is called the cochlea. The cochlea then vibrates with the sound waves, which triggers very tiny yet powerful. There's thousands of these dudes. They're hair cells, and these hair cells continue the moving of the electrical signal to the auditory nerve. The auditory nerve eventually connects back to the brain, starting at the brainstem. Now we get to the brain. Remember the temporal lobe of the brain from earlier? The auditory cortex is located here. And fun fact, the auditory cortex is actually connected with a lot of different parts of the brain while listening to different kinds of music. Within the brain, the sounds of music can start to be interpreted in specifics, such as frequency, pitch, rhythm. The right side of the brain is typically stronger with interpreting pitch and harmony, while our left side of the brain is better with speech and language processing. Within the left side of the brain, there are actually two specific areas that are directly tied to how we analyze, understand, and express words, but also lyrics in the sense of music. One of these major areas is called Wernicke's area. Wernicke's area is a place on the left side of our brain that helps with the comprehension of words, and in the case of music, lyrics. The second area is called Broca's area, which is an area that helps us to form speech. If Broca's is damaged, speech production is severely hindered. So in the case of music, this would consequently affect singing and songwriting. With Wernicke's, language and music comprehension is impaired, which can consequently affect how we interpret music. Now, why is music so addicting? What keeps us coming back for more? This can primarily be linked to neurotransmitters, specifically one reward transmitter called dopamine. Dopamine helps create feelings of pleasure. Dopamine is primarily released in the striatum, which is one of the brain's oldest structures, which is primarily involved in pleasure processing. When we hear music we like, dopamine is released. When we hear music we don't like, cortisol, the stress hormone, is released. Think back to your favorite song of all time. When you listen to this song, your brain activates the reward system, flooding your system with dopamine neurotransmitters. In a study conducted by individuals who experienced chills during their favorite song, it was eventually concluded that dopamine actually affects the same parts of our brain that can be activated by things like drug intake. This finding later led to a ton of research conducted on the similarities of brain activation with things like food, drugs, sex, and music. In some specific studies, music was compared to having the same addictive tendencies as cocaine. This will also be covered more in depth in later episodes, but music can also have a really strong correlation to our limbic system, or the system that regulates and processes behavior and emotions. The most commonly heard correlation is music and the amygdala. The amygdala is a brain structure that is primarily involved in emotional regulation. So when we are really happy or we're really sad, this is typically the part of the brain that is involved in processing and regulating these emotions. When we hear different music, the amygdala can help us evoke different emotions from our interpretation of how we feel about the sound. This can also be why we associate different songs to different emotions. This is why we are able to reminisce and feel past emotions through the listening of one song. This is also why a lot of couples will have a song that they call theirs. And this is also why we avoid or replay certain types of music that we know will have a specific effect on our mood. Jumping ahead, let's take a look at how our brains can see written music. For all my instrument players or vocalists out there, imagine you have some of your favorite sheet music in front of you. In order to see and interpret this music, we have certain functions in our brain, specifically our eyes, that allow for this. Some of the most important functions are called rods and cones that are located in your eye. Rods are cells that specialize in low light functions, while cones are cells that can help us see color, as well as specifics such as the little flag on the end of an eighth note. These cells both help send important information over to different lobes of the brain. For instrument players, this information is then relayed to our frontal and parietal lobes, which combined help with executive decisions and sensory processing, which can also later be linked into the actual motor functions of playing. This is not the entirety of how we are able to see written music, but this is the long-winded answer of how certain functions in our eyes and our brain can connect and help us see music and also understand it. Now, how are we able to learn music? And is it harder as we age? Basically put, when we learn music, we increase the number of neural connections that we have. These connections across the brain are adapted and changed as we learn new skills, practice current skills, or even forget past ones. This is commonly referred to as neuroplasticity. When we play and learn music, certain connections in our brain, such as auditory connections or motor connections, which is primarily for instrument players, these connections are affected and strengthened. The strengthening of these connections can also help the overall brain function of musicians, especially with thinking faster. Some individuals have even reported having better analytical skills and mental habits after consistent practicing of music. A few studies have actually even tried to correlate the effects of music learning on other skills, but a lot of studies have specifically been done on the effects of music learning on mathematics. So I actually also wanted to bring up this really interesting story about music that I found out about maybe a week ago, and I had no idea that this existed, so it was really interesting to unpack. But in the 1990s, something was created called the Mozart effect, which was a really heavy assertion that listening to Mozart's music increased IQ. This was actually specifically geared toward infants, like newborn babies. And all these studies tried to prove that babies gained crucial spatial skills after listening to Mozart's music. And the part that I found really funny about this, too, is that the Mozart effect actually went statewide. So a Georgia governor actually created a program to give free Mozart CDs to infants. In the end, we still don't know if this study is true or not, but most people then not believe it to be false. I kind of lean on that side of the argument, too. Personally, I don't really believe that infants will become smarter after listening to music. I do believe that listening to music at a young age can help with certain functions and cognitive skills, but it's a really big claim to say that infants are simply smarter after listening to Mozart. Speaking of the interaction of music with babies, is it harder for adults to develop skills for music learning? The short-winded answer is yes. However, it is not by any means impossible for adults to develop these proficient skills that can be helpful with music playing. Back to the concept of neuroplasticity, our brains are actually capable of a remarkable amount of change. It's really insane. So as we age, it might be difficult to form these neural connections to the degree of speed that we can as a child, but this doesn't mean that our brains are not capable of doing so. The reasoning behind this is also why a lot of parents will tend to enroll their children in music lessons at an early age. Speaking to my family, my brother and I were both involved with music lessons at a really young age, probably 7 years old for me, 9 years old for him. These types of learning capabilities are easier when we're younger, but this does not mean that we can't develop these skills or, you know, strengthen cognitive and motor functions if we take lessons or practice music at an older age. So if that's any convincing, you can still pick up an instrument right now and, with practice, reach the same capability that you would be able to as a kid. In summary, music has a lot of effects on our brain, from the way that it first reaches us in sound waves to our ears, to the way that our brain can understand and interpret specifics such as pitch and harmony within our different lobes of our brain and different sides of our brain. Music can also be read within different receptors in our eyes. I talked about rods and cones. Obviously, there's a lot more to unpack there, but those are two really important cells that can help us kind of see and interpret music. These can also relate to frontal lobe processing, and for instrument players, the motor skills of actually playing music. Music can also affect our bodily functions and our emotions. Again, the most specific one I mentioned was about the amygdala, which is the brain function that helps process and regulate our emotions. The addiction of music is strongly correlated to the release of dopamine neurotransmitters, which can be comparably similar to the effects of drugs. I also mentioned how studies have been done to compare it to the effects of cocaine. Lastly, music can help with neuroplasticity, and younger individuals can create new neural connections faster than older folks interested in learning and practicing instruments or voice. Again, this being said, this does not mean that older folks do not have the capabilities to play, but it just might take them longer. If you guys are interested in learning more about the specific cognitive effects of music, I really recommend the book called Every Brain Needs Music. It's by Larry Sherman, who dives into the neurological effects of music during listening, improvisation, composing, reading, and more. It is a really great read, and it's a great basis for those starting out on the topic. It's actually really interesting, too, because he'll pull from a lot of studies that use MRI scans or fMRI scans, and it's really cool to see visual representation of what goes on in our brain during these functions. Additionally, a really great resource is Danny Lee on YouTube for all my people out there that prefer video formatting over books. It's a really great resource. He dives into the brain processing of music on a much deeper level. So with Danny, it's mostly biological and neurological, where with Larry Sherman in his book, it's a lot of case studies and improvisation and composing stories. But in the end, both resources are really easy and really digestible for individuals who are just starting out with an interest on this topic. Thank you guys so much for listening to the first episode of The Sound of Science. I am truly so excited to take you guys with me on this journey of learning not just how the brain functions with music as well as the body and our emotions, but also on the journey of how to teach through podcasting, as this is a first for me. Stay tuned for our next episode that is hopefully coming out in 2 weeks. Until then, make sure that you follow the podcast on Instagram under The Sound of Science. There are also underscores in between each word for those wondering. Thank you guys so much again, and I will see you next time.